are now listening to the Serious Growth Podcast with your host, Leo Costa Jr.
Welcome to Serious Growth Podcast, where the truth is told. On today's show, we have a gentleman by the name of Tom Naughton. There you go. And Tom is very well known for the movie Fathead. You wrote and directed that movie. Is that right?
I did.
And I really want to get into that. You know, I'm really interested in people, the path that they go on and sort of where they're at right now. And I went through yours and I really liked it. But I have to tell you something, first of all, with regard to Fathead. I've been in the bodybuilding and fitness world for 38 years and competed at the world level. And I have to tell you something. You got it right, Tom, in that movie. And most of these, everybody else has got it wrong, dead wrong, you know. And even like in bodybuilding, the guys, I was surprised because I interviewed guys, you know, some of the top guys. And some of these guys just follow along. They're being told what to do, and they're not really students of the game. And surprisingly, even at that level, they've got it wrong, you know. But I want to get into that. But I did notice that when you first started, you were a professional writer and an editor for Family Safety and Health magazine.
Yeah, that was my first job out of college. So we're talking way back in the 80s. And we got it all wrong back then, too, by the way.
So is that, you know, your first job, were you is that just what was that came along? Or were you living in Southern California at that time?
No, that was in Chicago.
Oh, Chicago. Okay.
Yeah.
And so that was your first job. I mean, the title of the magazine that you wrote for, it's a magazine, right?
It's a magazine, yes.
Yeah, it pretty much says it all. And then I thought that was interesting. And then you started working as a freelance writer. So did you get tired of just doing that type of, did you need to expand your wings or something?
I did. I was not a happy 9-to-5 kind of guy back in those days. And there was so much else I wanted to try. I was a musician at the time. I was hoping to get a band together. I decided I'd gotten some freelance opportunities, and it seemed like they would be enough to replace the job. And they were for a while. And so I quit to go freelance. And then I eventually moved into stand-up when I realized I was never going to get a band together.
That's funny. And of course, you were a software programmer as well before. And then this all happened before you became or got into stand-up comedy, which I wanted to ask you, how did you determine and stand-up comedy? Did somebody tell you you were funny, or did you think you were funny? How did you get into that?
I had, during my freelance days, hang on, I got a frog in my throat.
Yeah, no problem.
It's not a joke. I had, during my freelance days, I'd actually published some humor pieces. I published just kind of funny essays in the Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Sun-Times, Playgirl magazine, believe it or not, Omni. And eventually, people kept saying, you're funny, you should try stand-up. And at the time, my attitude was, no, I'm clever, they're hilarious. And but eventually, around the age of 30, that's how long it took me to actually become courageous enough to get up there. I went up to my first amateur night, and I basically got up and said the type of things that had been selling as humor for essays, and I got, I think, one mild chuckle in 5 minutes.
Ooh!
Yeah, and that's when I realized that written humor and spoken humor are cousins, but they are not the same thing.
Was it one and done, or did you like trying to keep honing your craft?
Well, that was such a positive experience. Pardon me. That it took me about another 6 months to go out, develop the courage to go up on stage again. During that time, I didn't just sit around. I went and worked as a doorman at the Improv in Chicago. There was an Improv in Chicago at the time. And I mean, it was close to a minimum wage job, but what it did was it gave me the opportunity to watch professionals work. And, you know, I would be there in the room for 8 or 10 shows per week. And that's when I began to get the rhythm of it, that what's funny to hear and what's funny to read are related, but they're not the same thing.
Interesting how you start learning that side of the craft.
Yeah.
You know, I've always thought that, because I love watching stand-up comedy. I watch all kinds of it, you know. And I'm just amazed. I think for me personally, I think that's one of the hardest jobs that you could do, because you're just up there and you're just,
totally.
I mean, it's just totally. You, baby. And when you bomb, woo!
And it's all on you. You're your own writer, director. I'd been in bands and, you know, we would have nights where we felt like we were really rocking and nights where, maybe not so much, but you can't really tell that much from the crowd reaction. Right. I'd been in, done some theater. If you're doing, say, a dramatic play, you don't really know how the audience is responding. I mean, they're watching. They're sitting there. They're quiet. It's what they're supposed to do.
Right, right.
If you're doing stand-up, your job is to make them laugh. And yeah. If the show comes out and it's crickets, it doesn't matter that that same material had them rolling in the aisles two nights before. You feel like a failure.
Well, I can imagine that. I mean, that would be, I guess you either... I mean, do you actually ever get used to that, or do you develop a thicker skin, really?
You absolutely, you have to.
I would think so.
And you have to realize after, and it takes some time to finally, for me, took some time to kind of grasp this and embrace it, but you can do a show on a, you know, in a club. In fact, I won't even go general. I'll give you specifics here. I had a week at Zany's in Nashville, good club. And I mean, rolling in the aisles. I didn't have a bad show all week. Every show, rocking. They're laughing their heads off. And then two nights later, I had a show in Jackson, Tennessee. I'm doing exactly the same material that had rolling in the aisles 2 days before. I barely got a few chuckles. It was really? Sometimes you get one audience that loves your material, and then a different audience, you just don't connect with them. Just something you have to accept. It goes with the territory.
And is there any way that at times, like if you're feeling like you're bombing, because of course you would know that.
Yeah.
Is there anything other than, I mean, through experience, is there anything that you can do to recover and rebound and turn that thing around?
Sometimes. So I did a show in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And it was a weekend, and I dressed the way I would have dressed for a weekend show in Chicago. In other words, I had on a nice shirt and a black coat, and this was a two-show night. And for the first show, they laughed, but it was what I'd call polite laughter. And I'm thinking, what is going on here? But then I kind of looked at the audience, and they were not nearly as dressed up as I was. And so I realized I was overdressed for that crowd. And by being a little too big coat looking, you know, too big city comedian, I'd created a little distance that was unintentional. So for the next show, I got rid of the coat, got rid of the nice shirt. I think I put on, I don't know, like a halfway decent looking sweater. I looked more like them.
Yeah. One of them.
Much bigger laughs that show. Sometimes it's all, you know, it's not necessarily material. It's kind of, do they feel comfortable with you? Do they like you?
Yeah. The only way that I can relate to you in any way at all, because I never tried to do anything like that, comedy, but I was in bodybuilding. We had a pose, you know, for exhibitions, and of course that was part of our sport. And I was asked to come to Sweden, of all places, to do back in those early 90s, it was really big for us to go not only do seminars, but also do posing routines for people.
You know, they
did love to watch his post. So I am at this Sweden event, big event, and I come on and I went through my routine. Now, mind you, most of the crowds, all of the crowds up to that point for me, they go crazy when they see you posing and they're just really into it, you know. Sweden was quiet. You could drop a freaking pin in that place. And I go, oh my God, I must look horrible or something, you know. Well, anyway, I asked the promoter afterwards and he said, well, in this culture, they think it's rude for the, while you're performing, for them to be like yelling and you know, it was so weird. And I tell you, I felt like crap, you know, before they told me. Hopefully, he was telling me that was the truth. But no, but he said that that's in their culture. They see it as rude if they're doing that while you're performing. So that was interesting for me. And I didn't like that feeling, Tom. I got to tell you.
Well, so now I'm thinking back and realizing perhaps I had some Swedish audiences here in America during stand-up days. And no one bothered to tell me that we don't want to laugh during his routine. That would be rude.
Yes.
So now I have a connection. Thank you.
Even though it's even though it's a comedy act.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Brother. Okay, so then what gets you into the, I see then that the transitions here where you, about, then you got into this humorous documentary about lousy health advice, and this is when I assume that you came out and did Fathead, is that right?
Yeah, so kind of what gave me the impetus to do that, I was doing stand-up, I was working cruise ships, I enjoyed it. It's a, cruise ships are, it's a great gig. You're doing two or three shows a week, and you're cruising.
Yeah.
But then my older daughter got to be around, I'm going to say, maybe 2 years old, to the point where she could communicate and all that. And I called home from a five-week gig, and she got on the phone, and she was all, hi, Daddy, blah, 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 blah. Then she got silent. Then she started weeping. And then my wife finally told me she's been crying every night because she misses Daddy.
Oh, brother.
Up to that point, I didn't realize it was having that effect on her. And that just hit me like a ton of bricks. So basically, I hung up the phone and I thought, this just ceased being fun.
Yeah.
So I told the booking agent, I will finish the gigs that you have on the books. And then I'm not doing cruise ships anyway. I can't do this to my daughter. I didn't know it was affecting her that way. So it was a little depressing at first, but then I think it was ultimately a good thing, because if you're a creative type, eventually your creative energy says, I got to go somewhere.
Yeah.
I can't sit in here. And where it eventually went was I started looking for something I'm going to produce myself, something kind of humorous, kind of informative. And that ultimately led to me doing Fathead. So it was a good thing for me that the stand-up had to go away, because that's what gave me the push in that different direction.
Funny how things work sometimes, you know, it's hard to figure out, but yeah. And I, like you said, I think when you're creative, because I didn't really understand and knew that I was a creative type until I got into the sport of bodybuilding. And
right.
Then all of a sudden I was like, I didn't know this even existed, but I just knew I needed something. I was an athlete. And then there was that one day, then all of a sudden my sports career was over at the college level. And this is where I ended up on the dairy, because it was a family dairy. I didn't know where else to go. Nothing really interested me except sports, and I wasn't following that anymore, you know?
Right.
But there was that buzz in there, and I made a promise to myself back then when that happened, when I ended up on the dairy. I was married then, and I just thought stability, you know? And that gave us stability back in those days. But I told myself, I promised myself, if I ever got that feeling, that buzz that the sport gave to me, the sport world, that I was going to jump. And that's how I got into bodybuilding. That's why I always listening to people's stories, how they got into like where you're at now.
I think it's a similar urge. In fact, an agent that I had for a while, we lived in LA for 10 years, actually made Fathead when we were still living in Burbank. And an agent that I was with for a while told me that he preferred to sign retired athletes and stand-up comedians.
Really?
And as a comedian, and like a lot of comedians, I'm not exactly blessed with a lot of athletic ability. I never played any organized sports. And to me, these sounded like, why are you interested in these completely different people, athletes, comedians? He said, no. Your personalities are actually very similar.
Really?
It's the personality that says, give me the ball.
Ah.
I want the ball. I will take the risk. I will get it done. I will do it in front of people who are noisy and screaming and yelling and all that. And as soon as he put it that way, I realized, yeah, because like you said, stand up, one of the scariest things you could do.
Yeah.
As you said, well, maybe it's about as scary as it's 4th and 1 and there's 3 seconds on the clock. And you got to take the ball. It is actually a similar challenge. And when he put it to me that way, I understood. And it actually gave me a whole new appreciation for athletes.
Yeah, you know. And
I kind of realized physically we're different. Mentally, there is actually some similarity.
I totally agree. And I never would have thought that until you just said that. The way he put that.
Until he said it.
That's interesting. Funny thing was, speaking of that, in sport, I actually was a quarterback, and talk about somebody who wanted the ball. You know, I wanted the ball every snap. I mean, that's how that was. And then all of a sudden that one day it's gone. It's like, holy crap. You know, and it set in. The more I was on the dairy, it's like, man, you know, this is no bueno. This is not going to work out for me. So, you know, and now at that point, it's like, how often do you get like a second chance at something right. that you really love to do? So
right.
I just thought, well, you know, if it happens to come around, I'm going to jump. And that's exactly what I did. And my life changed forever in the best way mm-hmm. possible, you know, and I'm sure you can understand that. So what got you, what was the first thing that you did then? Because like I said, I watched your movie and I found it really funny. Just, you know, I really liked your take on that. But what actually got you into that side of it? Okay, you're not an athlete.
Right.
And I'm assuming were you overweight at that point or something like that?
Yeah, I spent a lot of my adult, teen and adult life overweight. So emotionally, the topic did matter to me. But kind of what got me into Fathead specifically, so this was at the point where I realized I can't do stand-up anymore. I got to find something else to do. My idea originally was that, okay, I want to develop kind of a funny but informative show that looks at different topics, you know? So I was imagining like a half-hour episode show. Half an hour of kind of funny but informative stuff on this topic, on that topic. And so kind of the way you get something like that going in showbiz is often you just go shoot the pilot yourself.
Yeah.
So I planned to shoot the pilot and I was looking around for topics. What topic do I want to do? And it occurred to me, I don't like the way we treat fat people in American society, the way we make it their fault.
Yeah.
We tell them it's all about them. You're lazy, you're gluttonous, you're stupid, et cetera, et cetera. So I started looking into that. Okay, I'm going to shoot a half hour episode on that. That finally prompted me to watch Super Size Me, which I'd never bothered to see. And by the time I was done watching Super Size Me, I was doing a lot of pausing, taking notes, because I thought it was amusing. I thought it was also completely full of crap in many, many ways.
I agree.
So by the time I was done watching Super Size Me, I had decided I was going to do my own reply. And that ultimately became Fathead, which is what it started out as. But you've seen it. You realize it's almost two documentaries stitched together, part one, part two. Part one is, here's what's wrong with Super Size Me. Part two was where I finally got into, and here's what's wrong with the dietary advice.
Right. Really interesting. You know, I wrote a book with, I don't know if you heard of this, Dr. Mauro DiPasquale. Have you heard of him by chance?
I haven't read anything by him, but the name sounds familiar.
Okay, well, when I was bodybuilding, I contacted him because I saw his, he had an ad or something in one of the muscle mags. Well, he's a doctor and a brilliant one, and he has a certain degree that I can't even tell you now. It's been too many years. We ended up writing a book together called The Anabolic Diet. And basically, it was a high-fat diet. And he's written also ketogenic diet. If you look him up, he's still out there. And anyway, so during this time, I was in bodybuilding, and he said, this is very controversial at this point to do a high-fat diet. Dr. Atkins had a low-carb diet, he called it. He didn't want to call it what it really was because back then, I mean, if you think fat is a culprit now, which it's not, back right. then, yep. it's even worse. So they didn't even want to mention that. You know?
So in your case, what year are we talking about, roughly?
That should have been around 92.
Okay. In there, height of the low-fat movement.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, so Mauro was really interesting, man. This guy was like to the nth degree. And so anyway, so it's like we jumping into that thing caused we wrote a whole book on this thing. And when I saw what you're in your Fathead program that you were talking about, one of the things that I learned right away is, number one, it's a transference of calories in, calories out. If you take a look at physiologically, which most people don't, you know, the unsuspecting, the consumer, we're followers, and we're going to go, oh, that sounds really good. SOS, right. I call that SOS, shiny object syndrome, you know. And so when I saw what you were doing with this thing, I thought, you know, you've got this because you're not a product of what you eat as much as you're a product of how much you eat,
right.
You know, and that's what I really liked about that. So one of the things that you and I have in common is that over the years, even when I first wrote my first training courses, I was always known for talking straight to people. And even if it was counterintuitive or counterpopular, and that's one of the things I really liked about you. And the thing in that movie, you were telling the person why,
right?
You know, so tell me how then you got into that thing. Of course, you were exposing Spurlock is his name, right?
Yeah.
And I saw where you couldn't get anybody to respond to you when you were wanted to look at his dietary, what he followed. So how did you like keep moving along in this thing?
So that scene in Fathead, by the way, was kind of a parody of Super Size Me, because he made a big deal of him trying to call McDonald's and they wouldn't talk to him. So he kept going, first call to McDonald's, second call to McDonald's.
Oh, I like that.
Like, all these people are horrible. They won't even take my call. Well, yeah. His people wouldn't take my call. That's exactly what I was demonstrating. Like, yeah, buddy, you did the same thing when there's information you don't want to talk about. Yeah. But the way it went from being about Spurlock to being about diet in general is, keep in mind, I had dealt with being overweight myself. But I had lost some weight some years earlier following the Zone diet.
Yeah.
And I was eating at McDonald's while I was on the Zone, not all the time, but I was doing it, and I still lost weight. And so first off, I knew that what makes food bad isn't that it's fast. What makes food bad is it's got too much processed sugar, too many processed carbs, et cetera, et cetera. I already knew that. But I didn't quite realize yet that we'd been sold a whole bill of goods on the anti-fat, anti-cholesterol side of things. So since I decided I was going to do my own response to Spurlock, that I would eat fast food and lose weight, I decided I should do some research into what I'm actually going to be eating. Am I going to be eating too much cholesterol? Am I going to take in too much saturated fat? So jumped onto the internet and did research, and I kept coming across articles. No, saturated fat does not cause heart disease. And my first reaction was, what? But I would follow those links and then follow those links and follow those links. And by the way, I did write for that health magazine. And before I switched my major to journalism, I did 2 years of pre-med. I'm not afraid to look at a study.
Yeah.
You know, if I look at a study, I don't go, oh my God, it's science, I can't deal with
it.
I'm perfectly capable of reading study. So I would follow these links, and I came across people like Dr. Mike Eads and Mary Enig and Sally Fallon. And I can't even think of some of the others at this point, but I would follow their research all the way to the original study. And that's when it finally hit me. Wait a minute. The whole low-fat movement, which the magazine that I wrote for was part of, that's when it hit me like, we've been lied to.
Oh, yeah.
And by the way, the fact that we became afraid of fat is part of the problem. That's part of what got us onto the low-fat, high-carb diet. And I'm not opposed to all carbs, but when they are sugar and flour, you got a problem.
Yeah. No, good point there. In fact, in the anabolic diet that we wrote, one of the things that we talked about was that we started teaching people that fat is not the culprit, and then right. Here's why. And I think it's just really important. And even when you know the why, it's hard to get people's minds around that. But it really is. And when you start telling them that the real problem here is actually in the glucose that you're taking, especially if it's just too much. You know, if it's right. Like you made a point in that. In your movie, the bottom line is this: you can eat, because I still have one studio, and I've over the years I've seen thousands of clients that come through, and they say, but I eat healthy. I said, okay, so let me ask you a question. If I gave you a diet, because at this point it was all about the low fat diet, if I gave you a diet that actually has no fat in it, I took all the fat out of it, and if it takes 2,000 calories for you to maintain body weight and you ate 2,500 calories, but there's no fat in that, would you get fat? Most of the people would say no. This is how bamboozled they were, you know?
Right.
And they didn't really understand that part of it, you know? So I told them, I said, look, I can put you on a fast food diet, a junk food diet, as long as we control your calories, your caloric intake. You can drop weight on a pure junk, what's known as a junk food diet. And they just wouldn't get that. And, you know, and Mario said this way back when, he said, look, you know, if this is about the, you know, power and money in the industry. At that point, carbohydrates were the big thing, and there was so much money being made on making those kinds of foods. That's the reason why they were bagging on the real information. And you know that. The minute I saw the stuff that you were doing, I go, man, you know, you got this for sure.
Well, do you remember, so you said this was around the 90s when you were writing, researching.
Yeah.
And that's when everything was low fat. You couldn't walk grocery store aisle without every other label, if not more than that. Low fat, low cholesterol.
Yes.
And everybody was buying pasta makers, you know, and because, well, pasta is good for you because it doesn't really have fat in it. And oh my God, I look back. I still enjoy watching, for example, reruns of Seinfeld, and which was, you know, that show mostly ran in the 90s.
Yeah.
Love to take every episode and just clip out each little reference to fat is bad.
Right.
There were a ton of them in that show. And not just that show. It was just that the culture. It's what we all believed.
Yeah. When we wrote that high fat diet, because I understood this from a bodybuilder and being a student of the game, like you did your research and you know, you'd go to the nth degree, to the original link, the research. Well, I did the same thing. I learned this thing from the ground up, and I was a student of the game because I had to understand that this, and I had to go on that and do it myself and reproduce results over and over again. So I got this, you know, and that the doctor, fortunately, that I was working with, he also had this, and he was a maverick, you know. But when we wrote this, this book, The Anabolic Diet, I purposely went to service groups and I found the ones that had nutritionists and doctors that were in these service clubs. And Tom, you should have seen their head spin when I came in with this anabolic diet. And I called it what it was. I go, it's a high fat diet. And I said, it's healthy. It's actually healthy, way healthier for you than the carbohydrate based diet. You mean saturated fat? I said, yeah, saturated fat is healthy for you. In fact, and you probably know this, if somebody has a cholesterol problem, put them on a high fat diet, cut their carbs out or down, and all of a sudden the points drop about 50 points almost every single time.
You know? Yeah, and even points don't drop, the pattern shifts.
Right.
I mean, you get better HDL, the LDL do produce. My doctor occasionally, when I go in for a checkup, gets on me because my cholesterol is quote unquote high.
Right.
I finally, myself, at my own expense, because you can do this now with, you know, there are places now you can just go in and get a lab test that you want. You don't have to have your doctor order.
Right.
So I went ahead and got a complete lipid profile, which showed that, yes, my cholesterol is quote unquote high, but almost all the LDL that my body produces is the large fluffy variety.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I went ahead and got a, you know, coronary calcium score, which came back zero.
Yeah.
So at that point, the doctor was like, okay, keep doing whatever you're doing.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And we tied into that too. It's like, okay, what's the number? Well, it's a little bit high. Well, what's your HDL-LDL ratio? That's really what's more important, right?
And triglycerides. Doctors just kind of, they look at you know, your LDL's too high.
Right.
And then they say, my triglycerides are 75. You realize they're kind of just like, yeah, whatever on triglycerides.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, so many of these doctors, less than one, you know all this, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but less than 1% of their training is actually in nutrition.
Right.
And I got a big kick out of it because I looked into like life expectancy. And actually the doctor's life expectancy that time is like 58 and a half years of age. So I'm thinking, okay, wait a minute. So I'm going to go to him or her. And tell me about nutrition. Yeah. Something just doesn't, I mean, I understand that stress is maybe some of the reason why they don't last as long, but why am I going to go to them and them tell me about nutrition when in fact, you know, one of the best sources I could go to was actually a guy by the name of Don Ross, Don the Ripper Ross. He was a wrestler and a bodybuilder. And he told me one time, he says, if you really want to get good nutritional information, go to a world level bodybuilder because their bodies are laboratories. And we try everything. We try every way of eating that one can. So we see this, you know, from a different point of view. And but it really is amazing how some of these professionals out there, they really don't know what the hell they're talking about, and they're advising you and me.
Well, and I don't necessarily hold it against doctors so much because they're trained to do what they're supposed to do. And I try to avoid getting into a whole lot of Twitter battles, although occasionally I will indulge in one for fun, just because I'm feeling ornery.
Sure.
And so often, I'm sure you've gotten this. Why would I listen to you? You're not a doctor.
Right.
And we're talking about nutrition here.
Yeah.
Well, because of Fathead, I've gotten to know a lot of doctors personally.
Yeah.
I have doctors now I consider good friends. And they all say the same thing. We learn almost nothing about nutrition
right.
in medical school. My nephew is now engaged to a doctor. Mm-hmm. So I asked her, how much nutrition training did you get in medical school? She said, virtually none.
Yeah.
They are trained to identify the problem and prescribe the drug or the surgery or the device that treats the symptom. They are not trained in nutrition. And yet so many people, just the public, thinks they are. So you'll get into a Twitter battle with someone. We're talking about nutrition. Why would I listen to you? You're not a doctor. And I try to tell them that's makes as much sense as saying, why would I listen to you about nutrition? You're not a plumber.
Right. Yeah.
We're not talking about people trained in nutrition.
Exactly. Yeah. They're very trained for just very specifically. Yeah. And I didn't, and look, I'm not saying that I've run across some doctors that are pretty sharp, you know, they do understand this, but even did you hear that, that movie called The Game Changer? It was on Netflix just recently.
I've been trying to avoid it because I've been having a lovely, relaxing vacation, and I don't want to watch something that I know is just going to piss me off.
Yeah, you don't want to watch that. I'm telling you right now.
Sure, it's just. Besides, I have watched a couple of the other vegan propaganda films. It's always the same stuff. It's the same lousy observational studies.
Yep, that incomplete.
Really look at them. They don't add up. They don't make sense. So to me, I feel like it's just going to be, I'm sure it's going to be more of the same. I'll probably sit down and watch it someday, but I haven't. But anyway, your point was.
Well, and again, you know, one of the things I do just normally, and especially because of social media, what's happening in our industry now, you've got social media stars as trainers.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, they're out there. And of course, I got out of the industry of bodybuilding for a while, for about 13 or 14 years. And then I wanted to get back in again because I was reading Google. I still go to the gym and train all the time, every day. That's part of my life. And I was reading Google. And I was starting to read some of these things that these trainers were advising and suggesting that their clients should do. And I'm thinking, man, these guys don't know what the hell, and girls, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. I can tell by the way that the article is written and by the things that they're saying. So that got me all fired up again, you know. And I'm 64 now, and I was out of it for a while, and I came back in. And I tell you what, man, there is a lot of information out there that is kind of scary. And yeah. I always am interested to know in the why, and this is what's missing in our industry. It's just like with the that the Game Changer. I won't give too much away to get you all fired up here immediately. But one of the things that was pretty obvious to me, and then I questioned, is it bias or is it that the doctors don't know, and I don't know which one it was, but no one ever talks about the two metabolisms that your body has, that your body is built with, the free fatty acid metabolism and the glucose metabolism.
Right.
Nobody talks about that. And I wonder, and even in that Game Changer, there was all about, you know, the plant-based proteins versus the meat-based protein and which one was superior. And of course it was the plant-based, you know,
right.
There was all kinds of stuff that was just not, it wasn't a fair picture of, because they didn't mention, you know, the free fatty acid metabolism, because that would have changed right. that whole the way that they were getting some of their information, you know, but so much of it is just always out there. So how then with your Fathead, as because I watched, like I said, I didn't watch all of it, but I watched a lot of your stuff, so I knew where you were going with this thing. So did you end up? I know that it started out with you sort of mentioning Spurlock, but did you go any further with that as far as information?
So the whole second half of the film gets into where the USDA's dietary guidelines came from, how corrupt the process was, how doctors who were disagreeing with it were basically just ignored, and how we ultimately ended up with those guidelines because George McGovern thought he agreed with the low fat side. And then, you know, they brought in a scientist who basically said these guidelines are nonsense. And so because he wasn't telling them what they wanted to hear, they just replaced him with someone who would agree with the guidelines.
Yeah.
I don't think politicians should ever, ever, ever be involved in nutrition, because anytime you get politicians involved, no matter how good their intentions are, the process is going to go off the rails. It's going to be influenced by the wrong people. On top of which, there's no reason to have, and I have a whole speech on this called Diet, Health, and the Wisdom of Crowds. There's no reason to believe that one little group of experts is going to come up with the answer, as opposed to letting the answers arise from the crowd with all its many, many years of experience and different perspectives. The way we are supposed to get to the answer, I'm a big believer in the marketplace of ideas, is let the correct answers bubble up based on years of experience that people have.
Yeah.
It's not supposed to come from, we get one little group of experts together who declare the truth and hand it down to the rest of us. Any political process is the little group of experts get together and the answers come down, and that is the wrong way to do things. So basically, I don't think the U.S. government should have ever gotten involved in dietary advice in the first place. We were much better off listening to our grandmothers.
I totally agree. And the information that you're talking about is, my dad used to say, you know, it's hard to replace firsthand experience.
Yeah.
You know, and Albert Einstein said it a different way. He said, true knowledge or real knowledge is through experiences, yeah. You know, and yeah. That's exactly what you're saying, and it's obvious, because I look how many times things have changed. Like even with eggs, how many eggs you should eat a week,
right.
And then it was no eggs. And then it's like they really can't make up their mind as to which way is the best way. So,
right.
So how do we, you know, how is the industry going to correct itself, or will it ever? Because there's always going to be politicians.
It's already correcting itself. You mentioned the problem with social media. There's a lot of junk information out there. I agree, that's a problem. But ultimately, on balance, I think social media has been a huge positive force when it comes to diet and nutrition, because it is allowing the wisdom of crowds to operate. It used to be you'd go to your doctor, you'd get bad advice, dietary advice, or you'd go to a nutritionist or whatever. It didn't work, and you were told the problem was you.
Yeah.
Mike Eads talked about this when I interviewed him. I think this particular part was off camera, but he said, here's the typical pattern. People go to the doctor. I have high blood pressure, I'm overweight, whatever. Okay, doctor says go on this low-fat diet. You come back 6 months later. Oh, well, you haven't gotten any better, so it's genetic. Here's your drug. That was the pattern. Before social media, before the widespread the spread of information that we have now, okay, you talk to your doctor, you talk to a few friends, you maybe read a magazine article somewhere, but you really didn't have access to a whole variety of opinions. Now, because of social media, you do. You go online and you find out, oh, I'm not the only one whose condition didn't improve or maybe got worse on this low-fat diet. You start hearing from thousands of people who had the same experience. Now you realize it's not just you.
Right.
And now people start sharing their experience. But I went on this high-fat diet that my doctor told me would kill me.
Yeah.
Yet my cholesterol improved. My blood pressure went down. I started losing weight. And other people jump in and share their stories. And now it creates that situation, which we're supposed to have. It's the answers bubbling up, and they are based on experience, not from academic theories that were handed down.
Yeah, that's so actually...
I think social media is changing things in a positive way.
Actually, a very good point, you know, and that's part of the reason why I'm back out again, because I have a platform now on podcasting.
Right.
So you actually make a very good point. And I didn't think about that, but that's true. How much pushback have you gotten, and are you still getting pushback from that? What kind of response are you getting from that movie?
Well, at this point, I don't really get much negative pushback anymore, because I mean, we're talking about a movie that was first released in 2009. it kind of flew under the radar for a couple of years. And when it first really started getting attention was when it went to Netflix in 2011. It's ran for 2 years on Netflix, then it went to Amazon Prime. It's still on Amazon Prime. It was really around 2011 is when I got a lot of pushback. I got emails from a fair number of doctors, you know, who would look me up and tell me that my film was going to kill people.
No.
And the biggest pushback I got and still get when I get it is typically from vegans, because to them, don't eat animals is really not so much about health. It's a religion. It's their vision of morality.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter what science we talk about, what proof you offer. They're the equivalent of, you know, Hezbollah. There's nothing you're going to say to them that's going to change their mind. So when I get pushback from them, when I get pushback, it's from vegans who think that I'm an evil person telling people that eating animal flesh is healthy.
Yeah, how could you? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a hot topic. Like you say, it's like religion, you know. I know even in like the sport of bodybuilding that, you know, it's like, okay, what's the best way to put on muscle? Lifting heavier or lifting lighter weights? Right. Well, that thing has been going, that debate has been going on. And I guess it's like, you know, these long-term wars, it's never going to end.
Right.
You know, and to try to, to get in that kind of war, you're just kind of peeing in the wind, I guess. You know,
someone I don't remember who said this, but it was perfect. If you want to start a fight at a family gathering, talk about politics. If that doesn't work, talk about religion. And if that fails, talk about diet.
Yeah, no kidding, huh? Well, yeah. That goes on and on. So where do you go from here now? Are you thinking about doing something to let your creative juices out? Or are you just happy being on your farm now?
I love being on the farm. We don't really do a whole lot of active farming, but we have chickens. My wife has huge gardens during the growing season. I use a fair bit of the land for my own disc golf course, which I love doing.
Oh.
Most of the creative juices recently went into, I'll hold it up if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind at all. Oh, beautiful.
Fathead Kids. And we also have an animated film version out there that's on Amazon Prime and iTunes and etc. And the way this came about was after Fathead finally drew eyeballs when it went to Netflix, I got so many wonderful emails from parents telling me that their kids loved Fathead, which I thought was interesting because I didn't make it for kids. But it does have the animations, you know, some animations and a lot of humor. And I had parents saying, oh, thanks for making this because my kids are finally on board now with what I've been trying to tell them.
Yeah.
And so my wife and I decided, well, maybe we'll just make our next production actually for kids. So I'll hold it up again. My wife's an artist. So she did all these wonderful characters. She drew all the characters for the book and all the characters and backgrounds for the film. And then I wrote it. And then we wrote the book and we produced the film, basically explaining it at a kid level where we turn your body into a biological starship called the Nautilus, and you go aboard and you see how the crew works and how the crew responds to messages from food. And I'm a programmer, keep in mind. So yeah. I relate a lot of it to when programs receive a message, they respond the way that they're programmed, not the way you want them to work.
Right.
They respond the way they're programmed to work.
Yeah.
And your body responds to food as messages, and it runs the programs that have been built into your body forever. And so here's how all those work. And we basically explain how bad foods screw you up and how good foods can heal you by using that analogy.
I like that. I think it's really smart. You know, in my studios, one of the things I've done is reach out to the school districts.
Good.
You know, a lot of the kids are, you know, one in four or five are considered obese, or they're just heavy.
Right, right.
And of course, I think, you know, from my background, it's all about discipline. But when you're dealing with young kids, here's what I've seen over the years is sometimes, and a lot of times, parents will bring them to me because this is not a place where you come that's an open gym. It's a studio. It's a personal training studio.
Okay.
So I deal with different, you know, relationships. In this case, it would be, I've dealt with a lot of prepubescent kids. because they have these problems. Of course, you know, when you're like that and that age, bullying, there's all kinds of other things that happens to these kids. So I've gone and dealt with it at that level. And I said, look, you know, when you're talking to a kid, I always have the parents come in with the kids because I want both of them to hear this. Mm-hmm. Because I want to make sure the parents understand that this has to be presented to them. And this is kind of playing to what you're doing in a way that that they can, it's lifestyle and user friendly to them. And it's right. Okay if they go eat at McDonald's. I've said that so many times. It's okay if they have these certain foods in their diet because that's just part of life. And you can, it's not going to be something that's going to hurt them if you understand it to in a different way. And that's exactly what it sounds like what you're doing is you're changing these metaphors, I guess, right? And the way people are actually thinking about them.
Yeah, we really wanted something where, I mean, and this isn't for five-year-olds. It's probably for, you know, adolescents, maybe 10 years old and up.
Yeah.
But the kids have to, well, I put it this way. The subtitle you will see is stuff about diet and health I wish I knew when I was your age. Yeah. And that came because so many people would comment to me after they watched Fathead and they finally realized that, no, it's not the fat that's making them fat. It's the sugars and the white flours. And they would lose weight for the first time in their lives after many years of struggling.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many people said, thank you for making this. Man, I wish I'd known this when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I felt exactly that way. I was a skinny 10-year-old, but I was a fat 14-year-old, and it was all diet. And if anyone had known to explain to me when I was 12, 13 years old, what I know now,
yeah,
I wouldn't have been that kid.
Yeah.
I absolutely been willing to change my diet had I known that the cornflakes, you know, that I was eating were a big part of the problem. Now there are some kids who love junk food. You can explain this and they can fully understand it and they don't care. They want their junk food.
Yeah.
Okay, fine, if that's your choice.
Yeah.
The book and the film are for the kids who were like me, who would happily have made different choices if they just had the information available to them in a way that they understand it.
Yep, and I totally agree with you. Even like when it comes to to exercising, because my studio is built on, based on, three components: weight training or resistance training of some sort, cardiovascular conditioning, and nutrition. Those are the three components that impact someone, you know?
Right.
And even like when they come in, I said, look, you know, you're going to get a lot more out of this in the long run if you implement all three of these things together. So the idea when we bring them in is to, because I learned this when I went back to Bulgaria in 82 or 81 before I started doing this stuff. And what they do with their kids there is they, and again, you have to keep in mind that those kids at that particular time, they were put in sports schools. But it wasn't like I thought it would be. It wasn't like they had to be there. But for the kids that ended up in these sports schools, what they did with these kids is they made it fun. They made it fun, and yet they were actually getting them ready for something that was bigger down the road. But they made it fun. In other words, they made it palatable for them. And that's right. That's my idea when they come in to me is that, look, we're going to take these three components and we're going to make them fun. And then we're going to, you know, make it to where you want to come back 3 days a week. And all of a sudden it starts becoming a way of life. And, you know, this is where the big in the industry, these quick fix diets, nutrition, you know, which ones I'm talking about, Nutrisystems, right, and all those. Listen, if you take a look at the statistics, they do work, but they just don't work for a long period of time, because there's no infrastructure and they're very user unfriendly. And then you take a look at 8 months after, you know, these people buy the diet until they lose their weight, and then they go right back, as in you said in that movie, they go right back to the old way of eating. And then most of them are more shaped than they when they started. Hell, that's not the mark of a good nutrition program, is it?
No.
Gee, well, no. You know, and so they're just part of, that's kind of part of the problem.
I agree. I mean, when you have to, you know, you have to go eat like the food that they ship you, and then you're going to lose the weight. Okay, now what happens when they're not shipping you the food anymore? I mean, you have to learn how to eat this way yourself.
Yeah,
it happens. And it's, I think, and I'm sure you probably had to explain this to people many times. A good diet is not something you go on until you lose weight and then stop.
Right.
A good diet is something you need to adopt for life. Yeah. And I think a lot of us tried diets and went off of them because it was the height of the low-fat era, and a diet at that time was always these really tasteless low-fat foods. And basically, you're eating food you don't like, you're constantly hungry. And in my case, not only hungry, it's like I just didn't feel good.
Yeah.
And so I would try these diets and I'd lose a few pounds. And then you get to that point where your body is screaming at you, I can't take this anymore.
Right.
You finally go off of it and you blame yourself because you, quote unquote, went off your diet. You and I are about this. You're 3 years older than I am. So you remember when we were kids in grade school, there'd be one fat kid in your class. Usually some kid who had fat parents, that he had an endocrine problem. He wasn't necessarily less disciplined than the rest of us. Yeah. There was usually one fat kid. It wasn't a third of the classroom.
Right, right. I agree.
Like you often see now. And to me, the idea that, oh, it's all about why these kids have to just tighten it down and eat food that doesn't taste good and et cetera, et cetera. It's like, we weren't doing that when we were 10 years old. We weren't saying, why, I'm a lean 10-year-old because I'm on a diet. No, we were just eating real food, and our parents weren't at that time afraid of fat. And our grandmothers would have told us, easy on the sugar and easy on the flour because that's what makes you fat. That's what my grandparents believed.
Yeah.
And so the diet that was keeping us lean back then was just called eating.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just real food.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I did, I kind of studied the people that lived to 100. I was really curious about those people and what some of the similarities were. And one thing that was in all the group, it was about moderation being the key. They smoked a little bit, they had a little bit of sugar, you know, but one of the things that they did was they were active. They were in their gardens and they had to, not so much automation. So they were just active, but they did all those things. And I think that's a really good piece of advice, is moderation really is the key. Yeah. You know, and you can eat the fat and the sugar. And if it's moderate, anything that's extreme, I can give you a bottle of aspirin and tell you to swallow 30 of them, see what happens to you. You know, it's going to kill you. It's all like that, you know, but I think that you're really right on the money. Because when you start changing it at that level, because something that happened to me, Tom, about 8 years ago, is I had 3 strokes that paralyzed me in 3 weeks.
And I read that.
Yeah, and it paralyzed me, you know. And the doctor said, well, you shouldn't be here. You know, they couldn't find anything wrong with me, of course. And so I started studying about all this stuff, you know, because I had to find out. And, of course, I got back into changing this at a level, because if you don't change it at a young level, our kids are right now are having strokes at a much younger age, as well as women, you know. And so I was focusing in on those kids. If you don't change it at that level, it's not going to change down the road, you know. So I think you're doing a great service for the industry, for sure.
Thank you. And to me, it's, you know, I have kids of my own, and it's hugely important that kids understand this. And I'm really with you on the moderation thing. As I'm sure you've noticed, you can take any diet. It can be a good diet. And you have some people who, again, it becomes like a religious thing for them. You know, I know people who are on ketogenic diets. I'm glad it works. I'm glad you're doing it. But you have people who, I mean, they won't touch a piece of bread for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
And if that's what they want to do, fine. But we have a whole chapter in this book called It's Perfectly Good to Be Good Instead of Perfect. And if you tell people that the only way they're going to be healthy and the only way they're going to lose weight is to be perfect, you're going to lose a whole lot of them.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to say, I don't want to go the rest of my life having to be perfect. You don't have to be perfect. You have to eat a good diet most of the time.
Yeah.
It's New Year's Eve. Happy New Year's to you. Guess what? My girls are going to want to order pizza tonight.
Yeah.
And they will, and I will eat some of it.
Yeah.
And I probably won't eat pizza again for 6 months.
Yeah.
But it's New Year's. I don't have to be perfect. It's New Year. I ate pie on Christmas.
Yeah.
And I see people online who are, well, here's how you get through the holidays without eating any of that stuff. If that's what you want to do, that's fine.
Yeah.
But to me, that's where you're making perfect the enemy of good.
Yeah.
My diet's good. And good for me includes, if I want a damn piece of pie on Christmas, I can have it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's one of the downsides. Listen, bodybuilding for me was something that, I've said it before, it saved my life in a lot of ways. It taught me a lot of life lessons. But I tell you something, Tom, it's one of those kind of sports that when you go all the way in, which I did because I have one of those personalities, after all these years, I am like a trained idiot. And I'm kind of like that person that you're talking about. Like if Christmas lands on, because the way that I eat now is I eat very, very, what would be clean and healthy during the week, Monday through Friday. I intermittent fast. On the weekends, I just eat whatever the hell I want and as much as I want. That's how I've set up my way to eat, because most of the time on the weekend is when I do socializing. So if Christmas comes like on a Wednesday, like it did this year, I don't change my eating. And you know something? I could, but that's the side of it that gets nutty, you know?
Right.
That's extreme behavior. The only thing that I've learned how to do is because I compartmentalize, I have all the foods that I want to eat. So when Christmas and those days land on a weekend, buddy, I'm having an extra good time. You know what I mean?
But right, right. Yeah.
I know exactly what you're saying. And it's a lot smarter to have the kind of mindset and the strategy that you have. I think you're nails on this thing.
And I
couldn't wait to actually have you on, because most of the time, you know, I'm dealing with sort of the opposite of that. And I just really thought, you know, you I didn't know if you thought I was going to come on and, you know, maybe go against you on this thing in any way. Not that it would matter, but I just think that you just nailed it, and you're nailing it with this kid market. I think it's going to do very well.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Sure. Anyway, is there anything else you would like to promote on the podcast? I mean, you did your book. Anything else that you would like to tell us about that you've got going on?
Sure. If you don't mind,
the book,
of course, I will hold it up one more time. This is what we've been doing currently. I would like people who are maybe a little more interested in that whole idea of information bubbling up that's based on experience versus the stuff we've gotten from top down. I did a whole humorous speech on that topic that I think people would enjoy. If you just go to YouTube and you look up Diet, Health, and the Wisdom of Crowds. I'm mentioning that because I'm proud of that speech. There are, you know, often you have a lot of thoughts floating around in your head, and they're individually interesting, but then you finally have to figure out a way to put it into one complete work.
Yeah.
That speech is the thoughts I've had for years about what I call the anointed handing us down their information that's often purely theoretical. It's not based on experience, versus the experiences that we pick up on our own, the wisdom we had from our grandmothers that we eventually, to our detriment, ignored.
Yeah.
So that speech is one that I hope people will check out. I think they'd get a lot out of it.
Beautiful. You know, so many times now, because like you were talking about, like, you know, we didn't pay attention to our parents, even our grandparents. You know, I remember, you know, that being that young, dumb kid, and even an adult. And so many times since then, I go, boy, they're right. My grandma was right. My grandfather was right. My dad was right.
Yep. You
know, I guess I just had to get to this age before I figured that out. I don't know. Of course, I've been learning that throughout, you know, as I get older, but again, that experience, they've been around and they were right. You know, so
what's that saying? The older you get, the smarter your parents become.
Yeah, that's a true story.
Yeah.
Anyway. Well, listen, thank you very much for taking the time. I really I appreciated you coming on. I really wanted to have you on, and you did not disappoint.
I appreciate it. I had a great time talking to you.
Good deal. And maybe sometime down the road, if you got anything else that comes up and you want to share, I'd love to hear from you. I think you got a really smart way of expressing yourself, and most people can relate to that.
Thank you.
All right, man. Well, listen, you have a good New Year tomorrow.
And Yeah.
I'll be asleep by 8 because I have to get up the next morning to go train. You know, that's that downside to me. Okay. Well, you have a good day, man. I'll talk to you soon again.
Sounds great.
All right. Thanks for coming on. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Serious Growth Podcast. For more episodes like the one you just listened to, subscribe to us on your mobile podcast app and leave us a review. If you'd like to reach out, you can find us online at seriousgrowth.com. Until next time, train smart and train hard.